From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz. And we begin this hour with soccer. When we talk about the sport, Russia and the Persian Gulf nation of Qatar don't usually come to mind. But today, both countries earned the right to be the center of the soccer universe for one summer each. FIFA, the sport's international governing body, named them hosts of the World Cup. Russia in 2018 and Qatar in 2022. While those countries celebrate, the losing bidders, including legendary powerhouse England, not to mention the United States, are crying foul. NPR's David Green has a story.
So the 2018 FIFA World Cup, ladies and gentlemen, will be organized in Russia.
That announcement from FIFA President Sepp Blatter wasn't a shock. Russia's a world power with millions of sports fans. They've hosted the Olympics. Why not a chance for the World Cup? This was the surprise.
The winner to organize the 2022 FIFA World Cup is Qatar.
The head of Qatar's delegation, Sheikh Mohammed bin Hamad Al Thani, went up on stage at the ceremony in Zurich.
Thank you for believing in expanding the game. Thank you for giving Qatar a chance. And we will not let you down. You will be proud of us. You will be proud of the Middle East. And I promise you this.
The Middle East is getting its first World Cup, following Africa, which had its first shot this year. As FIFA's president put it,
we go to new lands.
Which is little consolation to England, a country that lost out to Russia, or the U.S., which lost the 2022 bid to Qatar. President Obama called the decision wrong, and former U.S. national soccer star Eric Winalda said Qatar, a desert country with 1.7 million people, will struggle to host the tournament. Oil and natural gas won today, Winalda told the Associated Press. This was not about merit. This was about money. Qatar does have gas and money, and it's vowing to spend billions of dollars to build stadiums and anything else that's needed. The streets of Doha were alive tonight with celebrations that drowned out Al Jazeera sports correspondent Joanna Gargoroska.
It seems absolute jubilation. Let me just show you around here some of the people. This place is filled up.
Those streets can get up to 130 degrees Fahrenheit in June, which could be Qatar's biggest challenge come 2022. The bidding committee has promised air-conditioned stadiums. Russia, of course, can get as cold as Qatar gets hot. That explains why not so many people were on the streets of Moscow cheering tonight. There was 39-year-old former Soviet military officer Viktor Megreladze outside a subway station. I didn't believe it up to the last moment, he said. We should, with honor, raise the flag of Russia and show the world what we're worth. Inside a warmer bar, a group of celebratory soccer fans were wondering aloud whether their country will live up to its reputation as corrupt and World Cup investment will land in the wrong hands. At least 22-year-old Dmitry Galkin was trying to stay positive. We'll get a lot of tourists, he said. Maybe they'll finally improve the roads. David Green, NPR News, Moscow.
Advice columnist Amy Dickinson normally concerns herself with affairs of the heart, not affairs of the state. But this week, WikiLeaks changed everything.
Dear Amy, some of my friends and I are in trouble. We wrote some things about some of our friends that were supposed to be confidential. Then someone got a hold of our notes and passed them around, and now everyone knows the stuff that we thought would be secret. I admit that some of the things we said weren't very nice, but hello, it was supposed to be private. Like, if I was talking about someone to his face, I wouldn't ever tell him that he and his friend remind me of Batman and Robin, even if it happened to be true. And I probably wouldn't say out loud that one of our friends was, like, boring, even though she is so boring that sometimes when I'm with her, I feel like I could basically pass out from her sheer torpitude. But look, now I'm doing it again. Well, what can I say? Everybody's mad at us. People are criticizing us, and now I feel like that's all anybody is talking about whenever they see us. We can just feel people judging us, and even if they don't criticize us to our face, we know what they're thinking. We just want for things to go back to normal. We want our friends to like us again. What can we do now? Signed, Stressed Out at State.
Dear Stressed, the hallmark of a good friendship is trust. And if people think they can't trust you, they're not going to want to hang out with you. You may catch your frenemies looking at you funny when you're in a receiving line or inspecting the troops. They may not want to sit next to you at the Bolshoi Ballet. They may even want to punish you by spreading rumors about you or by criticizing you to your face. And who could blame them? That's because they're hurt. When you hurt someone's feelings, you have to find a way to try to make things right again. So you have to stand up and admit what you did, take responsibility for your own actions, apologize, and ask for forgiveness if you need to. This will be uncomfortable for you. Your friends may want to see you squirm a little bit. Let them punish you for a while. Don't act defensive, and don't make things worse by piling on. Here's a basic rule of conduct. You might want to make a note of this and carry it around with you. Slip it in your diplomatic pouch. Remember this the next time you're tempted to criticize someone. If you can't say anything nice about somebody, don't say anything at all. Or at least, don't write it down. Your friend, and I really mean that, Amy.
Amy Dickinson writes the advice column, Ask Amy.
This is NPR News.
Tomorrow, the commission created by President Obama will vote on its plan to curb the rising national debt. Granted, the commission will only make recommendations. Congress doesn't have to accept them. But that vote comes as Europe struggles to contain its own deepening debt crisis. Sovereign debt is now a big problem on both sides of the Atlantic, but in different ways. And we're joined now by Jacob Goldstein from NPR's Planet Money to look at those differences. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, Guy.
How do Europe's debt problems compare with our own problems here in the U.S.?
Well, at the moment, Europe faces this big immediate problem. It's getting very expensive for several European governments to borrow money. This is true, of course, for Greece and for Ireland, the countries that have already received bailouts. But it's also increasingly true for several others. It's true for Spain, Portugal, Italy, even for Belgium. Now, the U.S., we don't have that problem. We can still borrow money pretty cheaply. And this is a very important difference. Because the U.S. can borrow money so cheaply, it's much easier for us to pay our deficits, at least in the short term. Now, in Europe, countries have to spend more and more money just to make interest payments. So they wind up either having to cut other spending or they fall deeper and deeper into debt.
But why is it that the U.S. can still borrow money, you know, relatively cheaply when Europe can't?
Well, basically, investors are losing confidence that some of these financially weaker European countries will ultimately be able to pay off their debts. And there are different reasons for this. You know, Greece got into trouble just because the government borrowed and spent too much money. The Irish government, on the other hand, they were doing okay until they tried to bail out their banks. And that wound up being a lot more expensive than everyone thought. But despite these differences, you do see a sort of herd mentality among investors where fear spreads from one country to another in Europe. At the same time now, investors around the world still see buying U.S. Treasury bonds, which basically means lending money to the U.S. government, they still see that as one of the safest investments around. So when people get worried about the global economy and whether this is the debt crisis now in Europe or even the big 2008 financial crisis, which of course was centered in the U.S., when worries like that arise, people still rush to lend money to the U.S. government. So it gets even cheaper for the U.S. to borrow money.
Jacob, how does the debt compare between the U.S. and in Europe? Is Europe worse off than we are or vice versa or what?
Well, when you step back from these sort of immediate issues and look at the bigger picture, you do start to see a lot more similarities between the U.S. and Europe. One big example is that America's national debt is about the same size relative to our overall economy as Spain's debt is relative to its overall economy and about the same size as Portugal's debt is relative to its overall economy. And then when you look at the longer term, you see in both the U.S. and Europe this big demographic shift that's going to put a ton of pressure on government spending. Basically, there will be a lot more elderly people who qualify for government retirement benefits and government health care benefits, and there will be relatively fewer working people to support them. So in Europe, we saw this recently starting to play out when we saw street protests in France when the government raised the retirement age. And in the U.S., we're seeing it this week in the case of Medicare and and Social Security, you know, both of which are big issues that President Obama's debt commission is trying to work out.
So bottom line, they are screwed, but we're less screwed.
Slightly. Slightly. We're all screwed. I mean, there's going to have to be really big shifts both in Europe and the U.S. Europe has this very acute problem where the markets are forcing them to deal with it right now. The U.S., we don't have that acute problem, but we're definitely going to have to deal with it as well.
Thank you, Jacob.
Thanks, Guy.
That's Jacob Goldstein from NPR's Planet Money team.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Austerity comes naturally to commentator Annie Corzin. She says the current economy has a lot of people dreaming of a thrifty holiday.
I have been a frugalista all my life. My wealthier friends used to mock me for being a cheapskate, but times have changed. And now my not-quite-so-wealthy-anymore friends are calling me for tips on saving money. I've spotted a few of them prowling the thrift stores for designer labels. They are even re-gifting. Recently, a friend who's always been known for her lavish presents brought me some scented candles as a hostess gift. I guess she forgot that she got them from me. For a thriftaholic like myself, the holidays are a real challenge. So much pressure, so much excess, and so much greedy materialism. Plus, I have a dirty little secret. I hate presents. I hate giving them. I hate unwrapping them and having to pretend that I like them. Wow, a vegan cookbook. I've been wanting one of these. But running the gift-giving race seems inevitable this time of year, so I've learned to make the best of it without spending a fortune. I rarely buy retail. Instead, I find low-priced treasures all year round at yard sales and thrift shops. Eventually, someone will appreciate that mid-century fondue set or that Bakelite bracelet or those vintage lace hankies. I sometimes give services instead of goods, like the time I coach my neighbor in public speaking. And she gave me a home-cooked chicken dinner delivered, which was a welcome gift since I would pay extra for a house without a kitchen. Cheapskates like me hate waste, so I never buy wrapping paper that just ends in the trash. Some Martha Stewart types save it all for crafts projects, but I am allergic to crafts projects. Instead, I use those gift bags that are two for a dollar at the discount stores. I never write on the message tag, so the recipient can use the bag again. I am not a total Scrooge. I do love those twinkling lights on the darkest days of winter. One tradition that we share with friends is a nighttime walk along the Venice canals in Los Angeles, with views of quaint little bridges, duck-filled waterways, and colorful holiday lights. It's a lovely holiday experience that doesn't cost a dime, until we pig out at the local Thai restaurant. And there is one present that even I enjoy giving. Every Christmas, I renew a donation of $25 a month to sponsor an 11-year-old girl in a poor African village. That money makes it possible for her to go to school. It's the perfect gift for me. No shopping, no wrapping, and I am pretty sure it's truly appreciated.
Commentator Annie Corzin is the author of Bargain Junkie, Living the Good Life on the Cheap.